lecture yesterday. Okay, I realize that many of you have not yet prepared for the extended supersymmetry. So just for the sake of the understanding, and something I sort of assumed you all know, but which I did not explain, is that when we make tests between gravity side and gauge theory side for ADS-CFT, for ADS-5, the simplest test we can make, the minimal one, is actually the symmetry rather than some excitations. So let's just remind what sort of symmetry we do have. On ADS-5 side, remember the way we generated ADS-5 out of hyperbolate in 4,2 non-compact space, and it has basically the form of x minus 1 square minus x5 square plus 4 vector square equals r square. And this is the hyperbolic in 6-dimensional space, which has signature 4,2, and therefore it naturally has a symmetry SO 4,2. Okay, and S5 clearly has SO6, and this is the space-time symmetry on ADS-5 side. On the other hand, if at all there is a duality between ADS-5 and ADS-5 gravity and n equal 4 super Young-Mill theory, then this symmetry ought to be realized as some kind of symmetry in Young-Mill theory side too. So let's look at the Young-Mill theory side, four dimensions. Okay. And this has n equal 4 supersymmetry, roughly meaning that I have four independent n equal 1 supersymmetry charges, and they are all in equal footing. Therefore, there is a rotation among four of them, and they are precisely transforming under SU4, and the fundamental representation, or equivalently, it's a spin representation of SO6. And this is precisely the symmetry of SO6 that you see in from S5 part. And the other one, this is the four-dimensional Young-Mill theory in flat R4. So therefore, it has a Poincaré symmetry. But this one, because this theory has no mass scale in the problem, it naturally extends to a conformal symmetry, which includes this Poincaré 3,1 symmetries as a subgroup, and that is known to be SO4,2, or equivalently SU2,2. And that's precisely this ADS-5 symmetry, SO4,2. So this is the minimal test one can make, in the sense that both sides, the symmetries we do see in space-time, and also in a superspace, precisely match with each other. Okay, so with that preparation, I want to move on now to the discussion we had yesterday, which is looking at some physical observables like Wilson loop and the corresponding quark, anti-quark, the static potential or force. Now, we will now move on some more tests by making some variant of that story. And the variant we'd like to propose is the following. Well, for certainly in the gauge theory side, not only we are interested in the zero temperature of that theory, but also at finite temperature. It's very physical. I just heat it up, and I want to see what sort of excitations they do to support in the theory. And if at all there is any correspondence between that gauge theory and the gravity on ADS-5, the background, there ought to be certain corresponding configurations in gravity side as well. And the question is what it is. Okay, at zero temperature, as we have already learned from last lecture, this is the space-time geometry in the bulk. So this one, this is full dimension, and this with the radial direction together, it is ADS-5, the blue part, and yellow part is the phi-sphere part. So this is the whole metric. And now at finite temperature, now there is a unique energy scale in the problem in Young-Mill theory, which is the temperature. That's the only scale in the problem. And that's very physical, and I measure all excitations in relative to that temperature scale. Therefore, that temperature scale has to be varied into the five-dimensional geometry as well. But in this theory, there is no mass scale at all, or no length scale in the problem. That's why we meant that the phi sphere is a maximally symmetric space, as well as ADS phi is a maximally symmetric space. And the overall coefficient in front of that, which you can multiply to the whole metric, is completely superfluous, because you can always rescale the coordinate such that the proportionality constant just drops off in any physical problem. So what do we do? The one thing we can think of is that because there's some thermal excitations, the intuitively one can think of some sort of putting some black hole, or maybe some heating the gravity system. Well, actually, in the particular situations that we're looking at, namely the Yang-Mills theory lives on three-dimensional flat space, then the corresponding the bulk geometry turned out to be a five-dimensional Schwarzschild black hole. Now the black hole is sitting in the ADS phi space. And here, this is the red part is precisely the change of the metric due to the presence of the Schwarzschild black hole at origin, r equals 0. And that the Schwarzschild factor is precisely this functional form sitting in here as an inverse of this one. This looks awfully like a usual four-dimensional Schwarzschild black hole in flat space, except now that the embedding space is ADS 5. But other than that, this Schwarzschild factor is essentially the same form. And this F, which is the coefficient of dt squared, therefore this is generativistic generalization of the static Newtonian potential, goes to 0 when r, this radial coordinate r, is essentially the coefficient in the numerator here. Okay? And that's the horizon. And this, and at the same time, the coefficient in front of the radial direction blows up as a simple pole. And so this is, if you believe me, then you can always check that this satisfies five-dimensional, the ADS-Einstein equation, or equivalently 10-dimensional supergravity equations of motion with the presence of the phi form flux, which makes this the phi sphere. Okay? So this ADS Schwarzschild black hole is a black hole which breaks supersymmetry. And another way of saying that is because of the presence of the horizon and also change of the metric signature when you try to cross r equals kt, then there is always some the heat bath generated. This is what Don has explained to you in great detail. The fact is that there is no globally well-defined time-like Killing vector. Therefore, the vacuum is not uniquely defined. And that's why you have the thermal heat bath around the black hole. So this system has well-defined mass scale or length scale, which is set by the coefficient in front of one of our fourth Newtonian potential piece. And that scale is something that must be related to temperature in Yang-Mills theory side. Indeed, up to some numerical coefficient you can always compute, this one, the coefficient to the fourth power is always proportional to t to the fourth, which is nothing but free energy or the free energy of the free Yang-Mills theory gas due to Stefan Boltzmann's law you all are familiar with. Okay, now I will take that for granted. In other words, the five-dimensional Schwarzschild black hole background in ADS space is dual to finite temperature super Yang-Mills theory. Now, how do I test it? Okay, there are many tests, again, you can make. Actually, let me just go back. Okay, just to remind you one thing, when I go this one, this is a Lorentzian, the ADS phi Schwarzschild black hole metric. But like usual Schwarzschild black hole metric in full dimension, if I make weak rotation from Lorentzian time to Euclidean time, such that this signature minus goes into plus, then this entire space is complete, judicially complete manifold on the range of radius r from kt to infinity. Now remember that r equal infinity is where the ADS, ADS ceases to exist. That's the boundary of ADS space. But now, as opposed to the zero temperature case, the radial variable in Euclidean ADS phi space cannot extend all the way down to 0, but stops at k times t, where k is some numerical coefficient. Okay? So it's basically cut off at around the scale of the temperature. And this temperature from Burke's side is this Hawking temperature of that black hole. Now we will see the effects of that immediately now. Now, so what sort of physics can we test? Okay, here, again, I want to, as a very concrete test, I want to compute quark anti-quark potential at finite temperature super Young Mill theory. And the answer you will see immediately now is precisely this form. And here, well, this looks kind of complicated, but just in words, very simple. The square root of the tubed coupling constant square is, again, the same non-analytic behavior as zero temperature. Numerical coefficient essentially same as, again, zero temperature. Now, potential is, again, one of R type, but except now that the potential, which is at very short distance, R near to zero is one over R, is cut off beyond certain scale. This is a step function. When R is larger than certain critical value R star, potential is simply zero, meaning that there's no force. So at very short distance, quark anti-quark potential is again 1 over R, like zero temperature. But if I try to pull out quark and anti-quark separation beyond a certain critical distance denoted as R star, then force simply goes to zero. So what kind of physics can I think of that in Young-Mill theory psi? That's the question. Okay? So the physics is very elementary. Now, if you remember plasma, classical plasma that you learned in electrodynamics. So what do we have? We have electron and proton. It's basically two component plasma of plus charge and minus charge. And they can efficiently screen any external, the non-zero charges you put into the system. So that's the basic nature of the plasma, because they can all move and react to the external electric field or equivalently to the charge. So say I have plasma, and then I put on some positive electric charge source inside it. Now, if there was no plasma, then by Gauss law, there will be 1 over R squared electric field all the way to infinity by the charge conservation. On the other hand, if it is surrounded by the plasma, what plasma does is basically screen, because of the Coulombic force, if I have positive charge here, the negative charge electrons will accumulate near to the positive charge source, and they effectively screen out to a zero charge, and that distance scale, that the effective charge, not the bare charge, going to zero is called a Debye screening length scale. And this is essential physics in classical plasma, but also applies to any finite temperature system which has both positive and negative charges in it. Okay? And Young-Mill theory is no different than that. And therefore, if I have a Young-Mill theory, and if I have some color source in it, then by finite temperature, the plasma effect, then the color electric field will be all screened out. And beyond a certain distance, you won't see any color field. And instead of the confinement, you will see basically screening. And therefore, the force will be going to zero. And that exponential tail, I mean, that tail you can compute. And that is called the Debye equations, a sort of the Liouville type equation you can always find in this sort of problem. And it goes in exponential tail form, like a Yukawa potential. And that scale is called the Debye length scale. And this R star is kind of reminiscent of that scale as seen from gravity side, simply because the force goes to zero beyond certain distance scale. At a very short distance, because screening is not efficient, it will see the entire bare charge. Therefore, it has 1 over R tips. So the intuition that you gain from usual classical plasma may be applicable here again, even though this is a very strongly coupled plasma. But that doesn't matter. Then basically, there is only one scale kicking into the problem, that R star ought to be related to temperature, because temperature is precisely the source of making the plasma out of the zero temperature Young-Mill theory side. So that's basically what you want to test. How do we see this R star being related to temperature, or from bulk side to the mass of the black hole? Okay, so that's the whole thing. So we will now compute, the computation is very elementary, but the goal we want to achieve is basically try figure out what R star is in terms of the mass of black hole, or equivalently temperature of the black hole in the bulk. So here, I again rewrite the metric just for the sake of our recording. This is the 10-dimensional geometry. This is ADS 5 with black hole, Schwarzschild black hole factor. And this is then the S5 part is completely spectator, so I don't write it anymore. And H, I changed my notation slightly. The KT is now more precisely of this form. And this looks kind of horrendous numerical factors, but just bear with it. And this Cauley F is precisely the Stefan Boltzmann law of the N equal 4 super Young Mill system. Stefan Boltzmann law treats basically super Young Mill theory as a free field theory. Therefore, I have a free ideal gas of the gluons and all the super partners. And if you compute it, which is very elementary, and this is it, and the coefficient is precisely dictated by the number of the super multiplet components. And N scale is obvious because all the fields are on the adjoint representation. So they have N scale matrix degrees of freedom. T to the fourth is again obvious because free particle, it will scale extensively. And by the dimensional analysis, free energy density has to go like T to the fourth. Okay, so with that one, the rest is dimensionless number. And the g square n, the toothed coupling constant to the fourth power, is just exactly the same as the zero temperature case, the z factor. And now the numerical factor in front of them is something you can compute from Einstein equation. Okay, so now the question is again repeating exactly the same computation we have done at zero temperature. In this background, I look at classical string, which ends and begins at the boundary of this ADS5 Schwarzschild black hole space, and look at the static configurations. Well, again, precisely by the same logic and same trick, namely, I just look at the partially gauge fixed number go to action, where partial gauging is such that world shift time is the same as the time in space-time. I get first integral motion, which is this form. And whenever you see this equation and just plug H to be 1, then you will immediately check if you wrote down the formula at the last lecture. This is exactly the same first integral motion as the zero temperature case. So now, slightly more complicated equation, but still, this is solvable by exactly the same reasoning. In other words, you introduce some fictitious analog coordinate where the coordinate is the coordinate of some analog point particle moving in Kepler potential. And then you look at the closed orbit of that system. Okay? First, you can look at just quark, single quark in that system. Again, it's a straight right angle to the boundary of ADS space. And at finite temperature, from that, at zero temperature, remember that from that straight string, which you identify as an infinitely heavy quark, you recognize UVIR relation, namely the relation between distance in ADS5 radial direction and distance along the four-dimensional Young-Mill theory direction. Now, this part, the black part, is exactly the same form. This is precisely zero temperature relations of the UVIR. In other words, length scale in the problem in four-dimensional Young-Mill theory, and the radial distance, the minimum, the tip of that string configuration, is inversely related, and that the coefficient in front of that is this non-analytic piece, square root of the toothed coupling constant squared. Now, at finite temperature, this m is related to temperature as a t to the fourth power, t power. And therefore, I would expect, because this already dimension is taken care of by this first term, I expect certain modification, which is a function completely the dimensionless. And then the only dimensionless combination you can just make up is the ratio of u star, which is the minimum deepest point of the string in ADS space, and the mass of this black hole. So this is dimensionless parameter, and there's a certain function f you can compute out of this first integral motion. Again, this u star has to be, again, large compared to m, meaning that this string does not yet hit the horizon of the black hole. Yes? OK, I have not explained that computation in this part of computation. But this is something you can compute from gravity side and gauge theory side. And then gauge theory side, you cannot really compute in the strongly coupled theory. But you can first compute at the weak coupling, completely opposite regime. And that's this. The Stefan Boltzmann law, okay? And in the gravity side, Remember, I don't have that transparency here, but remember that I related the partition function of gravity psi with the partition function of Yang-Mill theory psi. That means the free energy has to be also the same. Now, in the presence of black hole, I can compute the free energy. That's only the classical computation. And that way, you can relate, you can compare that the black hole free energy with the free energy of completely free Yang-Mill theory free energy. And very surprisingly, even though this theory is strongly coupled, the gravity side computation is only 3/4 of this one. And this the famous 3/4 is something nobody has yet understood. But still, it's very interesting that it's all the same order of magnitude. OK, so where were we? OK, so we were computing this UBIR relation. Now, this red part is something we expect a kind of the modification in UBIR simple relation due to finite temperature, where temperature is varied into m. So the question is, what kind of functional form do I get between L and U star? Because for given m, U star not only enters as overall one over U star, but also inside this yet unspecified function U star, which you need to solve this from first integral motion. OK, I won't go through detail, but I will just show you what the functional relation looks like. OK, again, the vertical axis is the Yang-Mill theory direction, which is the boundary of ADS. And this is the ADS-5 radial direction. And that's the U star is the deepest point of string that penetrates into ADS interior in unit of M. This is dimensionless, the variable which I used inside F function. Now here is the F function. This distance scale L in Yang-Mill theory and U star, which is the tip point of the string, is related in this very funny functional form. And now I want to contrast it against zero temperature relation. Zero temperature relation was just inverse function with each other. In other words, L times U star was constant, which was tubed coupling parameter. Now, I do have this funny finite temperature relation like this. Now, this one is very surprising, because at zero temperature, for any L, I always find corresponding U star. That's obvious. Now, here at finite temperature, when L is very, very small, I do find two intercept points. I have a U star, another U star, and so on. But beyond a certain separation L, I do not find any U star, the corresponding U star. OK? And that's the difference between zero and finite temperature. So but what is L? L was precisely quark anti-quark separation distance, and U star was the point, the deepest point in ADS for the string. So what it means physically is that when I try to separate quark and anti-quark beyond this distance, L star, then I do not find any dual configuration string, you know, because there is no corresponding minimum deep point of that string configuration. So what it means is that beyond this one, the picture that's from quark and anti-quark, there is some string connecting them and bended into the interior of ADS Schwarzschild black hole is completely wrong, because there is no corresponding L and U star relations. Only when L is very small, then I can find corresponding U star values. One very near to the boundary, the other one is very deep into the interior. Okay? So this is very interesting. That simply means that quark and anti-quark being connected by a string is completely wrong if the quark-anti-quark separation is sufficiently large enough. And that's very good, because string does not connect with each other. That means they don't know with each other, therefore there's no force. Precisely the same picture I already alluded by a plasma device screening picture. OK, so here I will draw it again. This is the boundary of ADS where the Yang-Mill theory is living. And here's a quark and anti-quark. The picture I show you here is precisely the one I already showed you at zero temperature case. Different, the closed orbit corresponds to different separation of quark and anti-quark. And when quark anti-quark separation is very large, then it penetrates deeper into an ADS interior. And this is center. This was zero at zero temperature. But now, at finite temperature, I told you that at R equals M or KT, there is a horizon, and interior of that is inside the black hole. So before doing that, I again remind you that in as opposed to this one, which means that quark and anti-quark is connected by a single string, therefore they know their presence of the other with each other. There is another configuration, which is the quark and bare quark and bare anti-quark, just going straight all the way down to the interior of the ADS space. And because they are separated string, they don't know the presence of the other, therefore they do not exert any force. And this we knew that at zero temperature was a higher energy configuration than this one. That was our interpretation of attractive interaction force. Okay, now at finite temperature, as I said, because the presence of the horizon, this is the horizon location, r equals zero is deep inside the black hole, and that's completely unphysical region from as seen from outside. Now imagine that you separate quark and anti-quark distance further and further. Now as soon as it goes certain distance, it will eventually hit the tip point, it will hit the black hole horizon, right? And at that point, near this black hole, the horizon, the local unknown temperature will be around the string scale or beyond it. Now, in other words, the local temperature is so high that this string, whose energy density is associated with string tension 1 over 2 pi alpha prime, will be melting immediately because temperature is so high. So as soon as the string touches the horizon, then string will be melting at the horizon. What do they do? Like some wires being burned out in the middle, they will just disconnect with each other. And because of this tension of the string, as soon as they get disconnected by burning at the horizon, the string will just go straight line like this, quark and anti-quark. Okay? And that's because of this burning effect at the horizon of the black hole. And so that's the interpretation. So when quark and anti-quark separation is very small, the horizon is too far away, their presence is a very negligible effect. But as you make quark anti-quark separation distance larger and larger, eventually it will hit the horizon. Horizon will immediately melt part of the string, and the disconnected string will just try to stay straight because of tension and minimizing the energy. And the final configuration will be this one. That means I have quark and anti-quark, which are completely free and which do not see with each other. Yes? Which two solutions are you talking about? Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Okay, well, that goes from this one. That configuration, that the string being melted, is precisely making the quark anti-quark distance going up from zero to this, the violet line. At this point, there's no solution. You can try to find out solution, but that turned out to be having the positive energy compared to the quark anti-quark. Okay, and that's this bifurcation point is precise the configuration. In this picture, the string, the deep point of the string just hit the horizon. And at that point, you can compute, if we try to push string further into the inside of the black hole horizon, you can still compute the energy. But if you want to compare the energy relative to this quark anti-quark in straight line, it has a higher energy. Okay. So therefore, this configuration is lower energy than string penetrating deeper inside the black hole horizon. Okay, yeah, well, there are two, but one of them has lower energy, and the negative attractive energy, the other one is always repulsive. Okay, that was the two points I mentioned earlier, okay, in this UV-I relation. Sorry. Okay, so there are always two. Okay? And this one is always inside the horizon, and the other one is outside the horizon. This one always has positive energy relative to free quark and anti-quark. This one is always the relative negative energy, in other words, attractive force. So below this tip point, that's in U star coordinate, this is inside the horizon. Even though I drew this UVIR relation, the string configuration corresponding to this part actually has a higher energy, so it's not a stable configuration. Any other questions? Okay, so now we understood more or less the device cleaning picture as seen from gravity. In other words, string being melted by the black hole local temperature. And the computation-wise, it's very elementary. All you need to do is the same computation now, including this Schwarzschild factor in the previous formula you've seen yesterday. And again, it's a divergent. The energy is divergent simply because quark anti-quark self energy is infinite. So you have subtracted out. Now, the difference, this has to do with your question, why there are two solutions and one of them is unstable, the other one stable, has to do with the fact that this quark mass at finite temperature, self energy, even though it's infinite, is different from self energy of the quark at zero temperature. And that's again very easy from this picture. So what is the quark self energy? At zero temperature is this length of string times tension, where length is from this point all the way down to U equals zero. But at finite temperature, string has to end because it just melts. There's now no string there. It has to end here at the horizon. So the distance difference between zero temperature quark and finite temperature quark is this much. Therefore, finite temperature quark has less energy. That's very easy to understand, again, by plasma screening. The self-energy of quark, which is charged object, is lower than zero temperature case where there's no screening effect. Okay? So that you have to take into account. And with that subtraction, the procedure is again the same. Now then using this UV-IR relation, I find the quark anti-quark potential of this functional form. And this H is again something computable, which is kind of complicated. I can always draw, but I didn't do it. And the potential is precise as a step function, though the cosper-type form I alluded earlier. And to illustrate what the functional form is, when L, quark anti-quark separation, is very, very small, then we will see very tiny, minute corrections to quark anti-quark potential of this zero temperature piece. And H is expandable in powers of L, quark anti-quark separations. And that is expansion in one over square root of G square N. There's two coupling parameter, which is very large. So this is small parameter expansion. Okay? Good. Now I want to entertain a little bit with that finite temperature thing, something that I will further go on in the next lecture. Now, having learned that you can turn on the finite temperature to zero temperature super Young Mill system, something I did not mention to you, but something that should be obvious to all of you, is that by turning on temperature, the N equal 4 supersymmetry here is all gone. The reason is because when I have the temperature in usual quantum field theory formulation, I use Mascara Euclidean time formulation. So that means I have a compactified time. The time, Euclidean time zero, and the beta has to be identified. What it means is that the path integral, which is the integral of Boltzmann weight, e to the minus beta h, to from zero time zero to beta, is the closed path. And for the finite temperature case, the fermion has to be such that it is the supersymmetric breaking boundary condition, because that's the way we compute the free energy. And therefore, the supersymmetry is completely broken. And so using that fact, one might try to relate to some other non-supersymmetric system we know of, namely QCD, or pure Young-Mill theory, which has no supersymmetry whatsoever. Okay? First of all, as you all know from finite temperature field theory, if you have finite temperature, then fermion obeys the anti-periodic boundary condition. Therefore, they cannot have zero energy state, because along the time direction, which is the interval from zero to beta, you have to be in anti-periodic boundary condition. Therefore, there's no zero mode. So they already acquire some finite thermal mass at finite temperature. Now, boson case, like a scalar field, they will acquire some mass, again, proportional to temperature at one loop level. And now, because it's a one loop, it's suppressed by some Young-Mill coupling parameter G. But anyway, it is finite mass. It has a finite thermal mass. Therefore, it's again massive. The only object which will be massless is gauge boson itself, because the gauge invariance prohibits any generation of the mass for them. So at finite temperature, if you look at a very low energy excitation compared to temperature, then the only exciting you do have is basically pure Young-Mills theory. As soon as your energy hits the temperature scale and beyond, you will see all the degrees of freedom associated with n equal 4 super Young-Mills. So that's what you would expect. So basically, if I first consider very high temperature of this, the black hole geometry, or equivalently very high temperature limit of n equal 4 super Young-Mills theory, then at any finite low energy excitation, the degrees of freedom you see is only pure glue theory. Therefore, it's like a usual Young-Mills theory. So the idea is basically just the invoking that to in a more systematic way. Basically, here is the step. Okay, you start with the Euclidean A-5 Schwarzschild black hole. Now, this one is already Euclideanized. Now, this was three space, spatial directions. Now, I want to rotate back one of the space coordinate as I times the another Lorentzian coordinate, let me call tau. Then this one looks like basically 2 plus 1 dimensional Lorentzian space now embedded into ADS5 Schwarzschild black hole. Now one way of seeing why that is the right procedure is very elementary. You're solving Einstein equation or 10 dimensional type 2b supergravity equations. Now that equation is analytic with respect to the metric parameter here, Gij. Now in Gi, because it's a simple the nonlinear differential equation, I can always change my metric into complex domain, and in particular I can change GTT and G11, for example, into complex parameter domain. And that is completely okay because you're solving Einstein equation, and Einstein equation is analytic in those parameters. Now in complex domain, I can start with this minus signature and go all the way to plus signature, and at the same time, one of the plus signature go all the way to minus signature. Then again, solves Einstein equation. So that's the procedure I do. Then now the interpretation of this one is slightly different. This is one of the time direction is precise like a usual zero temperature ADS. One of the space direction is now warped by this Schwarzschild factor, 1 minus kT to the fourth divided by R to the fourth. So now this is the space. Of course, again, when R goes to infinity, then this approaches ADS5 space, where one direction is now compactified. But other than that, this is essentially the signature changes, doubly weak rotated the configuration. So now, so therefore, the interpretation is the T direction is a space direction now of the funny D3 brain configurations. And when T, along T direction, I use the thermal boundary condition as the earlier case, then the supersymmetry is completely broken, and then the fermions will be massive, and the scalar field will be massive in one loop. The only low energy excitation I see is this gauge field. Now the gauge field now lives on not just R4, but R3 times S1, where S1 is the time direction. So if I make the time direction is very, no, sorry, this is new space direction. If I make the space direction very, very small, meaning it has very high temperature in this interpretation, then any finite low energy excitation won't excite any Kaluza-Klein state in that T direction, and therefore I have one less dimensional the gravity system, and therefore correspondingly one less dimensional Young-Mills theory system. And that's the idea. That way, we will get some, starting from this ADS5 Schwarzschild black hole background, we will get the ADS-CFT dual type configuration for some theory which is compactified on S1. Therefore, it's a three-dimensional gauge theory. And the same idea can be applied to any other D brains. Now, so far it's a D3 brain, but D4 brain or D6, whatever you want. You can always do the same, the considerations. Sorry. Okay. So this is about basically what I said, and because it's thermal, it breaks n equal 4 completely. at low energy, very, very low energy compared to that, the compactified T direction, I will have only three-dimensional Young-Mill theory system, simply because I'm looking at the energy scale very small compared to that, the compactified scale. In other words, I'm basically dimensional reducing my four-dimensional Young-Mill theory down to three dimension. There will be always junk as soon as I excite my energy comparable to the first Kaluza-Klein state in that direction, both in Young-Mill theory as well as in gravity. But if I look at very low energy and make at the same time the circle size very, very small, I can look at the excitation of this, the three-dimensional Young-Mill theory by looking at the excitation in the corresponding gravity system. The simplest one is a glue ball. Glue ball is a state of pure glue, which is gauge invariant. And now gauge invariant configuration will always couple to the bulk geometry, for example, stress tensor of this glue ball, which is gauge invariant energy momentum tensor of the gluons, will always couple minimally to the background graviton. Now, though this glue ball spectrum can be computed, and that's very elementary, you just look at the supergravity in this particular background we have taken, and then look at linearized equation of motion. The reason why you look at linearized equation of motion is because we're looking at the low energy, and at low energy, gravity, because gravity is always derivative coupling, all nonlinear coupling will drop out. And basically, you are only left with quadratic piece of the Lagrangian. That means you're looking at the linearized equation of motion, and then solve normalizable, and then try to find out normalized solution of linearized gravity equation of motion. Okay? So that way, one can compute the global spectrum inferred from the energy spectrum as seen from solving linearized gravity equations in that background. There are many states. This notation, I hope, is very clear. It's J is this. The first one, and superscript denotes the discrete symmetry, parity, and charge conjugation. And if you remember QCD in old real world, then the lowest glue ball configuration has a spin zero, parity positive, and charge conjugation positive. Okay? Now in 2+1 dimensional world, this is not the world we live in, but nevertheless, computer can do it. And in fact, lattice gauge theorist has done a lot of very precision calculations on the system, and they computed the spectrum of this one, the same quantum number, lowest mass in certain unit. Here, certain unit means the physical length, the physical scale, and that you can compute from the string tension. And so the lowest mass in that string tension unit is this number, and the same quantum number, the next excited one is this one, and the third one is this one. And this one is too difficult, too expensive on a computer. This is at n equal 3, Kala n equal 3. You can do n equal 4, n equal 5, n equal 5, 6, 7, 8. And this is a very time-consuming and expensive experiment. But you can do it. And in fact, you can do some sort of extrapolation. And then add, but if you extrapolate to n equal infinity, it doesn't really change much. It just slightly shifts downward. Now, this is the result we already have from lattice gauge theory. Now, if I compare with the ADS-CFT computation, in other words, solving the energy spectrum of linearized Einstein equation in the background, then the number one gets in, again, the same unit, first you have to normalize the same, this number into 4.07 is basically just this rounding off this n equal infinity number. This you first assume to be the same. Then the test is that whether the excited state will have the similar pattern as lattice gauge theory result, which is a pure glue theory. And this is quite surprising that number is not so different. Okay? It's not humongously different. So this is a good sign. One can play again for 3+1 dimensional case, starting from not D3 brain, but the D4 or sometimes D5 brain. And you can do the same trick in gravity as well as in Young-Mill theory side. This is the real world, and we do know from our particle data book that the lowest stable glue ball has quantum number spin zero, parity, charge conjugation positive. Again, you look at that one, you can look at some other things too, but here I only show you this zero JPC being 0++. And again, lattice data at n equal 3 is only available simply because I have one more dimension the computer time is so expensive, so you cannot really do extrapolation all the way to infinity. Anyway, so for given this this data, then you compare with ADS-CFT. First, again, you just identify these two numbers, the lowest one, as an input. Then you look at the high excited state. It's quite surprising that the next one is quite close with each other. And this fits quite reasonably well. And in fact, this kind of game has been played a lot over the during the first stage of this ADS-CFT correspondence. And in all cases, it fits extremely well. And actually, the question, the point is whether it fits well or not. But the real question is why it should fit so well. Because if I look at this pure Yang-Mills theory, then this is the theory which has UV fixed point. In other words, a complete closed theory. It has no other degrees of freedom, even if I go to very short distance or high energy. But as compared to that, this gravity side or corresponding dual gauge theory side, we have a hell of a lot of junk in it, because as soon as my energy hits the inverse radius of the compactified circle, not only I do see this 3 plus 1 dimensional Yang-Mills gauge field, but one higher dimensional gauge field and fermions and scalars, it has infinitely many more degrees of freedom than this pure Yang-Mills theory side. Now, given that junk, the question is, why do they match? Is there any reason why we should believe they match? In fact, there's some theorem due to a Jaffe at MIT that if you look at the hadron spectrum, no matter how many junk you put in, the result will be always universal and the same. And therefore, in that, if you really seriously take that viewpoint, then this test of the hadron spectrum as a way of checking ADS-CFT is probably not the most efficient one. Okay. Now, we'll go back next lecture on some of the issues relating ADS-CFT to real-world QCD. But let me just sidestep a little bit. And here, I want to make one comment about the square root of toothed coupling parameter square that I argue that is very strange because it's non-analytic. If you have some function, so if you have some physical function which I alluded as double slit expansion in perturbation theory, and if I look at some fixed power in Planck expansion 1 over n, for fixed h, then the rest is a single series expansion in lambda. So if I look at in lambda coupling constant space, in complexified lambda space, then we do have a lot of information from weak coupling side from here. Okay? And near lambda equals 0, any physical quantity has an analytic expression. In other words, there's no pole, no branch cuts or poles very near a lambda equals 0. There's some poles hitting to appear somewhere outside, but that again has an interpretation in terms of instanton and anomalons. But now the perturbation theory we are doing is somewhere at infinity here, and we have seen that there's a square root of lambda square, and that there's a branch cut here. Now, if you have a square root branch cut in complex plane, then this one has to end somewhere. Otherwise, it will just penetrate deep into small lambda, and maybe it just disappears in negative lambda square, which is on physical region of Dyson instability. But this is completely wrong. We already know that from weak coupling perturbation theory, such branch cut should not appear. So the question is, what is this one? Is this branch cut or square root branch cut of toothed coupling parameter real or some kind of fake? Actually, it turned out to be, this has been one of the most surprising results we learned from ADS-CFT in the beginning. But later on, we had some better understanding. Essentially, the physics that goes behind explaining the square root is the following. So here, I give some very elementary, some model of computing Wilson loop. And here, Wilson loop is zero dimensional. This M is a matrix, which is a counterpart of analog of gauge field or n equal 4 super Yang-Mills multiplet. Now, you can view this as a path integral over gauge field, like n equal 4 super Yang-Mills. And this is action. Now, I approximate that action as quadratic piece. And the coefficient is one over lambda squared. Remember, it was n over lambda squared. N is not an issue here now. I only look at one over lambda squared piece. And this is the analog of the Wilson loop, because there's no space-time. This is zero dimension. There's no integral. E thrice e to the m is zero-dimensional counterpart of the Wilson loop. Now, when you evaluate this integral, this is a matrix integral. Now, you don't want to just do this one in hair of detail. All you want to see is whether you can, what sort of power of lambda dependence you will get out of this integral. Now, it's extremely elementary that this piece m squared is quadratic, has a coefficient quadratic in 1 over lambda, whereas the Wilson loop has a single power of m. Therefore, it's not surprising that this result, this integral, has some dependence on lambda, precisely single power rather than square power, because this Wilson loop has m single power as opposed to quadratic power, as in the Boltzmann factor or action. So that is kind of intuitive explanation why we have seen square root of this lambda square rather than lambda square itself, and that's the explanation of the origin of this branch, square root of branch cut. Now, if we try to compute further fractions by including nonlinear terms and so on, then it'll make the story more complicated, and that has been computed by several groups, and the answer is that actually the square root branch cut is some artifact of leading large n, large lambda expansions. And then you can see from some elementary function that you know very well, which is a modified Bessel function, or known as a McDonald function. Now, if you look at the McDonald function, there's a modified Bessel, at very small argument, it has a very well-defined the tail expansion definitions, where it depends on this expansion parameter like lambda square in analytic power, so there's an integer power. But if you look at the large argument asymptotics, then it all has this McDonald function or modified Bessel function has asymptotics, like exponential of square root of z, where z is the argument. And the square root is very universal, and that explains why you have square root of lambda square rather than lambda square itself. And that's precisely the same phenomenon, just in terms of mathematical functions. Okay? So you should see, you should understand the square root as only an artifact of strictly infinite the lambda square infinite and n equal infinity. When am I supposed to stop? I have about 10 more minutes. No organized here? Okay. Okay. So let me then go on to the next subject, which is about the baryons. Now, baryon, you know very well, proton is a baryon, neutron is a baryon. You all know from your undergraduate physics course that in SU3 QCD, the baryon is made of three quarks just forming Carnot singlet. And this is a physical observable. Now, if you try to do the same thing by extending rank of the gauge group to SUN, then the baryon consists of n quarks, here QA, QB, dot, 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 lambda, there's no lambda, QC, is just this quark, and there are n different species of quark because gauge group is SUN, and totally anti-symmetric configuration of that with respect to that color indices is the baryon configuration, okay? Now, we want to see the baryon in n equal 4 super young male. So like we said, in meson, this quark is infinitely heavy. Therefore, if I put them together like this, again, it will be again infinitely heavy. Therefore, this is not a dynamical object. We do not want to dynamics. We only want to see the structure associated with this baryons or some kinematic properties. What is the kinematic properties we know about the baryon? The first one is what is called enality. Now, if you look at the SU3 quark, and if you change each quark, they are in complex representation of SU3. Therefore, I can always make some global rotation. For example, third root of unity, omega, multiply that together because there are three. They all add up to unity. Therefore, I can always rotate by the unit, third root of unity element, the phase, for each of those quarks. The same thing goes to the SUN baryons. I can rotate each quark uniformly by nth root of unity this way, and then baryon is invariant. Okay? And this is called anality. And that has to do with the fact that this quark, there are n quarks inside SUN baryon, or three quarks inside the SU3 baryon. Okay? And in fact, this element, the nth root of unity, is in fact an element of SUN group, which commutes with all the rest of the group element in SUN, same thing for SU3. So that is called technically in group theory as a center element. Now, actually there's one subtle issue about ADS-CFT. When we realize this SUN large N limit gauge theory out of ND3 brains, then each of them, put them together, there are actually N square, the open strings connecting from one D3 brain to another one. It's not N square minus one, it's actually N square, that means the group, symmetry group of N stack of D3 brain looks like UN rather than SUN. And SUN is traceless one, this simple trace diagonal U1, you can physically understand as a central mass of N stack of D3 brains. Now, if the group is UN, then there's a profound difference from SUN. For the rest of the computation I did, for like a Wilson loop, a global spectrum, anything, there's no change whatsoever. However, the baryon is very important in checking whether the gauge group is SUN or UN. The reason is that if the group is UN, then center of UN is not ZN like this, but it's just simply U1. It's clear. Diagonal U1 will commute with everything. Now, if you SUN, you have only ZN element, because you have to have a trace of that the generator to be zero, or equivalent to the group element has to have determinant one. So if your group is SUN, you have this analytic condition for the quarks. Therefore, one out of many gauge invariant configuration would be N quark baryons. It's obvious. But if your group is UN, because your center group is U1, you cannot form gauge invariant and this center group element invariant baryon configuration out of finitely many quarks. You need infinitely many. So in this case, there is no finite quark baryons, and in the SUN case, you have N quark baryons. So this is a very profound and important difference. And we'd like to test whether ADS-CFT says that the gauge group that corresponds to ADS gravity is SUN or UN. Yes? Oh, very good. So in the meson case, I do have gauge invariant configuration not only by quark but also anti-quark. The anti-quark will be in complex conjugate representation from the quark, therefore the phase that rotate, the center group element, will be complex conjugate of it, therefore QQ bar is always invariant. In that case, whether it's U1 or ZN, it does not matter. So therefore it's only the baryon which sees, which is very sensitive to anality, and the meson itself is not. So that's why baryon is of the physical interest. Now the answer is the following. It said the gauge group is actually SUN. And the U1 piece that the separate out from the SUN is something sitting somewhere at the boundary of ADS space beyond which is actually tandem space-time. This is technically called singleton in the supergravity jargon, but I won't go into detail. Basically, whatever happens inside SUN is interior of that ADS space, not at the boundary. And that SUN baryon has the configuration of the following type. Horizontal axis is again ADS radial direction. The blue one is the boundary where the Young-Mill theory lives. And on each point on it, remember we have S5, right, from 10 dimension. So on S5, in that theory, not only we have a fundamental string, but we also have D5 brain, because this is type 2 string theory. Type 2B string theory, then with that D5 brain, I can wrap this S5. That's fine, because S5 has a finite volume. Therefore, even if I wrap this D5 brain, it's not infinite energy configuration by itself, it's a finite energy configuration. Furthermore, remember that the S5 size is constant everywhere inside this ADS5 region, even though outside, in 10-dimensional space, the spherical S5 part will vibrate and becomes very, very large as you go far outward to asymptotic infinity, which is a flat 10D space. Now, this S5, the wrapped D5 brain, is part of the baryon. Actually, the way that you see that there are N quarks attached to it is realized by the fact that there are N fundamental strings connecting this D5 brain wrapped on S5 somewhere inside with the boundary, which is where the Yang-Mills theory lives. So there are N fundamental strings, and remember that each string is quark. And that there are N quarks, therefore this whole concept is precisely having the feature or property of the baryons that I alluded. Okay? Now, the rest of today's lecture is to explain why this kind of configuration, rather than solving explicitly, why this kind of funny configuration is something one should expect out of ADS-CFT. Now, it's a little bit of exercise of the story. The supergravity equation coupled to D3 brain, which makes up ADS-5 space, as well as some extra brain I put in, the D5 brain. Now, D5 brain, from Cliff's lecture that you might remember, the world volume action structure, here I just flash it only a quadratic piece rather than full nonlinear Dirac Bonin-Feld action. So the first piece is just F mu nu squared. But in the Bonin-Feld action, the D5 brain or D brain effective action, it always, this F mu nu world volume gauge field always couple to the NS2 form B mu nu. And of course, because B mu nu is gauge neutral, only the U1 piece of this non-abelian UN gauge field strength will couple to it. So I just wrote down here for single D5 brain, this quadratic piece of F mu nu squared. And then there's also a Chan-Simon term, which is the coupling between Ramon-Ramon background with D5 brain. And one term which is of relevance here is A, which is the gauge potential on D5 brain world volume, which with G5. And this is the one term. Now imagine, this is of course in a flat 10D space, or ambient 10D space. Yes? That's right. So this A is one form, this is a 5 form, this is a 6 form. So this is to be integrated over 6-dimensional world volume of D5 brain. No. Here, this is just, I just wrote down an just flat D5 brain. Okay? Now, here, I will consider then D5 brain wrapped around S5. Okay? So 5 spatial coordinate D5 brain is on the polar angle on S5. Now, then I look at one particular equation of motion which minimizes the energy of this one on S5. The piece I want to look at is A0 piece, in other words, just constraint equation, the Gauss law. And if I look at the Gauss law integrated form, then from this one I get just divergence E integrated over D5 brain on S5. And then from this piece, because there is a flux of G5 due to N stack of D3 brain, this will generate, when I vary with respect to this one, an integral over S5, I will get factor of N. N is number of D3 brain, which makes up the ADS5. Okay? Now, then, this one is just minimizing only from D5 brain the world volume energy. Now, this one will also couple to 10-dimensional type 2B supergravity field, because this B2 and G5, everything all come from 10D. Now, I look at, in particular, the equation of motion for B2. Now, on D5, it couples to on this world volume, but there is also 10-dimensional B2 field pervading in the bulk. So again, that the Gauss law for H3 field is this form. Now, clearly, the coupling is only on the world volume of D5. That's what I schematically wrote down here as a delta function. So divergence of H3, the electric field, the Gauss law, is proportional to electric field on D5 because of this one, and only supported on D5 brain world volume. The physics is simple. On D5 brain, if it has non-trivial electric field on it, it will act like a source for B2 potential. In other words, it will generate some H3 flux outside the V5 ring. Okay? So combining these two equations, we conclude that if there were some electric field turned on, which is indeed the case in the background of N stack of D3 brain, because of this equation, then the N bundles of fundamental string has to end on D5 brain, because that's precisely the way you generate electric field on D5 brain world volume, and it's also consistent with the picture that H3 electric field is generated by fundamental string. So I have D5 brain on S5, and I have N strings coming in, ending there, and create some electric field precise by this pattern. Now the question is, entire wall should be consisting this fundamental string on top of this D5 brain. And the question is, where are these coming from? Are these coming from infinity or from some other object? So that's the question. And of course, the answer, I will answer. So this is the part we already found. And the answer is that it comes from the boundary of ADS space where D3 brains roughly sit on, and that's the starting point of the N fundamental string, and go all the way down to D5 brain, and then deposit the electric field there. So how do I see that this is the second part, that on this D3 brain, N fundamental string ends? Again, it's similar logic. In tandem and supergravity, then on top of many other terms, there is a Chern-Simon term, which has this following form. It involves NS-NS2 form potential and 3RR3 form electric field, the field strength, and 5 form field strength. This has to do with the D string. This has to do with the D3 brain. Now, if I compactify this 10-dimensional effective action on ADS5 times S5, especially interior of S5, then I added here more the usual kinetic term. This is NS-NS piece, and this is Ramong-Ramong piece. And here, from this term, I get this one multiplied by N. Again, the reason why I get N is because I'm integrating over G5 over S5. That's precisely counting number of D3 brains. So then I have this term. Okay? Now here, I have a usual quadratic kinetic term, but also I have some mixing terms between B2, which is the potential of H3, and G3, and vice versa. So this will play some role. Now in this ADS5, now we also have a D3 brain at the infinity, right? Now D3 brain is again exactly the same form of Bohn-Infeld action plus Chern-Simon term. Now instead of the G5, it is also coupled to G3 in this case for D3 brain. And this term will be relevant. And for the sake of making the distinction between D5 brain world volume gauge potential and D3, A prime will denote the gauge potential on D3 brain world volume. Now I couple this D3 brain with the bulk and look at the equation of motion again. Now let's look at in particular equation of motion for two form potential C2, which is Ramong-Ramong potential for G3 field strength. And then it has this kind of form. So again, generalized Gauss law. Now C2 is the gauge potential for D string. Now in this system, I have not introduced any gauge, any D string. Therefore, the G3 field strength should be trivial. That means that if I just up to get, this is gauge in there, if I set it to zero, then this whole thing inside has to vanish by themselves. And that's basically condition I just read off, that electric field on D3 brain, which is at infinity, is proportional to N times B2, and B2 is precise coupling to fundamental string that comes from D5 brain to the boundary. So therefore, I have concluded from this equation that N unit of electric field is deposited by N strings, and that creates this ED3, which is proportional number of N. So this completes the proof, and the picture is precisely that. Now, the way of understanding this one is very nice, and there's some magic associated number A. The number A comes as a co-dimension between D3 brain, which makes ADS5, and D5 brain, which wraps S5. If you look at the local geometry, and they have a relative co-dimension A, and in this case, something very interesting happens. In flat space, not in ADS, the way this interesting thing happens is the following. Suppose I have some D3 brain, some number n. Suppose I have a D5 brain, and D3 brain is just penetrating out of blackboard toward you, and D5 brain is like this, and just pass through, okay? Now, if I pass through, instead of just nothing happening, there's something interesting happening between this D5 brain, which has passed from right to the left, and the D3 brain, some n fundamental string will be created and connect between the two. And this phenomenon is known in many different contexts, and it has there are several ways of understanding it. One way of understanding it is in terms of the walled volume anomaly when this D3 brain is present in your D5 brain. But one important thing which I won't have any time to explain is that when these n fundamental strings are created, they have a property of obeying Fermi statistics. Even though this whole thing has nothing to do with QCD, it has the precise right feature we want for having baryon vertex, namely each fundamental string or each quark obeys the Fermi statistics, and therefore n quark configuration like this one looks exactly like a usual baryon we learn from QCD course. Now there's an intuitive understanding this one. Someone who learned the magnetic monopole in quantum field theory course will also get some immediate intuition out of this explanation. Suppose I start SU2 gauge theory broken down to U1, and further I will break into some the modified vacuum structure, which I will explain later. Now I add a theta term. Theta term is topological term in four-dimensional Yang-Mills theory. In terms of U1 unbroken part, it's the elect times magnetic field inner product and the coefficients of theta parameter. This parameter is another coupling parameter in the theory. Now if I look at Gauss law in the quadratic equation, the quadratic piece of Lagrangian in U1 gauge theory, or broken SU2, then it's this one, simply because I have piece which is linear in E, then I have, instead of the usual Gauss law, I have E plus theta B has to obey the Gauss law. Now I integrate over some space on two sphere, then I get the integrated Gauss law. The first piece will give me electric charge, usual definition. Second piece, theta is some number. Divergence of B is no longer zero if I have magnetic monopole. So if I have monopole, then it will be proportional to magnetic monopole charge, okay? So now the physics is that in this gauge theory, if I have two polar coupled magnetic monopole, and at the same time, if I have the theta term, even though it looks innocent, it has profound effect of inducing electric charge to magnetic monopole, whose size is proportional to theta parameter here. And this was first discovered by Witten in 1979. And the physics is extremely simple, but the consequence looks surprising. So imagine that I have this theta value, which I said is just number, but imagine I just arrange the theta value from one value to another, from left half region of space and right half of the space. I can always do it, but say theta just jumps at this point, therefore derivative of theta is delta function here. I bring magnetic monopole from left and adiabatically move across this jump over the theta value, then what will happen is that this theta value, as theta value jumps from zero to some number, here it has no electric charge because theta equals zero, but as soon as it moves to the right across this jump, then it will have induced electric charge proportional to theta, okay? So the final configuration after it closed is basically I have some magnetic monopole with induced electric charge by Witten effect, and that's it. And I have this jump, that's the innocent configuration. Now, but something is funny. Here before, in this system, there was no net electric charge. The whole system has electric charge zero. But now, as soon as magnetic monopole has passed through, it acquired induced electric charge, but you cannot create non-zero electric charge out of zero. There must be some deposit of opposite electric charge somewhere else. There's no other place else, it's only on this boundary, okay? So as soon as it passes through this one, then it will have this effect. So this is the only place you will have the leftover opposite electric charge. So final configuration is that I have positive induced electric charge on magnetic monopole and completely opposite negative electric charge on localized on this theta jump. Now, because I have positive electric charge and negative electric charge, there will be flux tube connecting these two. Normally, it will be Coulombic field, but if you plunge this whole system into dual superconductor, then electric flux lines will all squeeze into flux tube like string, and this is the configuration. Indeed, this is the whole physics that underlies this magic eight for baryon vertex. So this is my final transparency. So just summarizing, baryon in ADS5 is basically D5 brain wrapped around S5, and by to minimize the whole energy, instead of these baryons pulling outward to the asymptotic infinity, it falls into a ADS5 and sitting anywhere. In fact, this is a BPS state, so somewhat different from baryons we see in the large gauge theory, in the sense that there is no interaction between two baryons. And there is a large electric field on the walled volume, therefore, actual solution is not precisely D5 brain wrapping on S5. It actually pulled out like a rubber band or balloon, and that final configuration is something one has to really compute carefully. But still, after that, all taken into account is a supersymmetric configuration. And again, I emphasize it's a very important configuration because it tests finite end physics associated with ADS-CFT, because this N, no matter how large it is, still baryon captures n-ality, and that this is a very important piece of finite N in Young-Mill theory. So I'll stop here, and my last lecture on Monday, I'll go over some application of ADS-CFT to instanton physics, and at the same time, some QCD-like phenomenon, like confinement and chirosymmetric breaking.
About UN versus SUN.
Good.
Isn't it true that there are sources you can place in ABS that will excite the U1 part of the dual base theory?
You mean from inside?
Yeah, so suppose you put a fundamental string and you compute the back reaction to some order in space time with source of B field that will reach the boundary and excite the U1 part.
Right.
So in the ABS part, there are sources that actually couple to the U1 part of the gauge.
Well, actually, the story is a little, So there's a way of doing it, but it's basically an issue about, you know, where you put the boundary condition. I mean, there are two different ways of pre-treating boundary condition, right? One is inside action, or in terms of explicit boundary condition of the field, right? So the, what you're saying is that I can just put into the action,
so,
and
so
still couple two.
My statement would be that there are two different ADS-CFT correspondences, one with UN and one with SUN.
But I think it's one and the same, but it's just different way of treating the boundary condition, isn't it?
Well, but it should get one first question. What if it was
ADS-CFT? Yeah, but this one says this is, that's right.
So, okay, so I'm not sure how clear that is, but I have another quick question. Which is, you mentioned the comment about
No, any gauge theory. Now that's super. Okay. Well, it's not enough. Probably he did not mean some Kaluza-Klein like massive state, but you just put arbitrary junk matter.
But at some energy scale, much larger than
that. Yeah. Okay. Beyond above lambda QCD, but not humongously high one. Okay.
Well, okay. But I guess the effect, the change in the potential spectrum would be, a border lambda over the mass scale that you're at.
Ah, okay. What he meant is that this ordering, like in a 0++ being the lowest mass, and 0++- is the next one. And of course, it will move up and down. They don't cross, even though you put in junk.
Even if I vary the mass of the extra matter that I'm
at? That's not. They don't cross.
Okay.